Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FSCom's latest webinar, What It Means to Be a PSD or EMD Individual. My name is Elaine Tai, and I head up the marketing in FSCom, and I've organised today's webinar. So, just to start off, if you do have any technical difficulties with audio or viewing the webinar, please refer to the confirmation email you would have received, or feel free to private message me in the chat area below or email marketing@fscom.co.uk and the team can pick it up there. So as it said, we have all joined the webinar in listen only mode, which means you are muted on entry. However, we would encourage you please to use this opportunity to ask questions via the chat form at the side, and I will read them out to our presenters later. So look, the format of today's session will be Rachel Stevenson, who I'll introduce in a minute, will lead with a 30-minute overview and presentation. And then we'll move on then to the panel discussion, where we'll have our director, Alison Donnelly, and other senior manager, Colin Sloan, who'll answer some questions then. So look, introducing Rachel. Rachel is senior manager in FSCom. She's worked in the financial services sector now for over 8 years, and specializes in helping firms get authorized with the FCA and also maintain that authorization on an ongoing basis. So without further ado, over to you, Rachel.
Thank you, Elaine, and hello to everybody. Welcome to our webinar this afternoon, where we're going to be looking at what it means to be a PSD or an EMD individual. As Elaine mentioned, a lot of the work that I do with FSCom is around helping firms become authorised. And as part of that process, we will identify all potential PSD or EMD individuals and submit an application for their approval as part of the application process. And for that reason, it's really easy to slip into the mindset that the PSD and EMD individual regime is something you need concerned with at the point of authorization and not really think about again on an ongoing basis. So what I'm hoping to get out of today's session is to really think about, well, what does it actually mean to be a PSD or an EMD individual? And by agreeing to take on that role, what is it you're signing up for? And so hopefully as part of today's presentation and the panel discussion we have with Alison and Colin later, we'll be able to draw out some of those issues and some of the questions that we typically get from clients in relation to what it really means to be a PSD or an EMD individual. So as part of the initial presentation, I'm going to give you a high-level overview of the regime. Then we're going to look at identifying who the PSD and the EMD individuals within a firm typically are, what standards the FCA will apply to those individuals, and what are the ongoing responsibilities once you've been approved. So we'll begin with an overview of the regime. As part of the FCA's supervision processes, certain individuals employed by regulated firms are subject to fit and proper requirements, and these individuals are known as PSD or EMD individuals. And the FCA want to be satisfied that those individuals are of good repute and that they have appropriate knowledge and experience to perform their role within the firm. And whether or not you will be considered a PSD individual or an EMD individual will depend on the regime under which the firm you're employed by is authorised. So if you are a senior manager within an e-money firm, you would be an EMD individual, whereas if you're a senior manager in a payments firm, you'll be a PSD individual. So like I said, at the point of authorization, all firms need to go through a process of identifying their PSD and their EMD individuals. And they need to provide the FCA with full and complete information so that the FCA can make a decision on that individual based on their reputation, their knowledge and their experience. And it's really important to note that the application process shouldn't be your due diligence process. It should be the provision of the information that you've already gathered as part of your due diligence and recruitment process. So, you know, how did you satisfy yourself that that individual has the appropriate skill set and the experience to work in a financial services business? And really, if you don't undertake that due diligence process before submitting the application, you could find yourself in a sticky situation where you've already recruited somebody to a role and then the FCF subsequently refused the application. So you've hired that person to fill a role which actually they're not able to do. So that would be obviously quite a difficult situation to navigate. So it really does flag the importance of conducting your own due diligence as part of your recruitment process before submitting the notification to the regulator. So post authorization, what are your ongoing notification requirements? Well, you need to let the FCA know when you appoint a new PSD or an EMD individual. You'll also need to notify them of any changes to the existing PSD or EMD individuals. So that could be changes around their fitness and propriety. If you know, any relevant matters which may impact their fitness and propriety, you would need to notify the FCA. And also if there's a change in their role, so if they move from being a senior manager who doesn't sit in the board and become a board member, you'd need to let the FCA know of that change. And then finally, if if a senior manager leaves the firm, you'll need to submit a remove PSD or EMD individual form. All of the notifications are submitted through the FCA's reporting portal, Connect, and appointments need to be notified before they take place, and removals should be notified within 7 days of that person leaving the business. So who are these elusive PSD, EMD individuals I'm talking about? Well, effectively, they're all directors and any additional individuals that are responsible for the management of the firm. And you'll note that I've highlighted all directors, and that's really just to remind myself to talk to you about non-executive directors. We quite often get asked whether a non-executive director would be considered a PSD or an EMD individual on the basis they don't typically tend to be involved in the day-to-day decision making. And the short answer and the most straightforward answer to that question is that yes, they should be notified as a PSD or an EMD individual, and that's based on the fact that neither the regulations or the FCA's approach document make a distinction between executive and non-executive directors, and from a Companies House perspective, there's no distinction between an executive and a non-executive director. So we would take the view that if they're listed on Companies House as a director, the expectation is that you would submit a PSD or an EMD individual form for them. In addition to directors, you'll need to include any additional individuals who are responsible for the management of the firm. But it's important to note that it's only to the extent that their role is directly relevant to the firm's e-money or payment services business. So for example, your HR manager, whilst they are a part of the senior management team, the FCA will need to be notified of them because they're not actively involved in the regulated part of the business. So I've highlighted here some of the key individuals that we would typically include as a PSD or an EMD individual. So in blue, we have the Chief Executive Officer or the Managing Director, and we also have the Chief Operating Officer. And those are the individuals that are typically responsible for the management of the firm. And we also need to include the individuals who are responsible for the internal control functions. So that would be the likes of your head of compliance or your money laundering reporting officer, or even your head of internal audit. And then finally in yellow, I've highlighted the managers with outsourcing responsibility. Firms are permitted to outsource some of the duties connected to their regulatory responsibilities, but they can't outsource regulatory responsibility. So a senior manager within the firm would still need to be responsible for overseeing those outsourcing activities, and that person would typically be a PSD or an EMD individual given that level of responsibility. Okay, so now that we know who the PSD and EMD individuals are, and we know that we're required to notify the FCA about them, what standards will the FCA apply when making a decision or when assessing that individual? So unsurprisingly, they're going to want to know if the individual has ever been convicted of a criminal offence, or if they're currently being investigated in relation to a criminal offence, and they might also want to know about civil proceedings that are relevant. So examples of offences under criminal law will include the likes of theft or assault and fraud or money laundering, whereas civil law is more concerned with the rights and the property of individual people or organisations. So whilst no one may go to prison, as a result of civil proceedings, you may be left out of pocket if you're found liable for compensation. So examples of civil law will include cases like family disputes such as divorce, or it could be personal injury case like a road traffic accident. Now, that's not to say that if you submit an application and to become a PSD or an EMD individual, that you will be expected to provide information on your recent divorce. And the FCA are really only interested in relevant matters. And those relevant matters would be the types of matters which indicate dishonesty, financial crime, money laundering, market abuse, misconduct or fraud, for obvious reasons. And the FCA would also expect to be notified of any relevant findings from other regulatory authorities, or any findings from the FCA in the past. So has the individual ever been subject to an investigation by the FCA or another regulatory authority? Have they been struck off as a director in the past, or have they worked at a business that has went into insolvency while they were connected to that business? So as you can see, there's an awful lot of different types of disclosures that individuals have to make as part of the FCA's assessment process, and it can be quite tricky to determine what types of disclosures the FCA would expect to be notified of. And so in that instance, our advice is always, 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 if you're in any doubt whatsoever about whether or not you should disclose something, you should always disclose. And that very much mirrors the FCA's position on it. Sorry, I'm having technical issues. And so the FCA themselves say that a conviction of a criminal offence will not automatically mean an application is rejected. We treat each individual's application on a case-by-case basis, taking into account the seriousness of and the circumstances surrounding the offence, the explanation offered by the individual, the relevance of the offence to the proposed role, the passage of time since the offence was committed, and evidence of the individual's rehabilitation. So the FCA do make the distinction between spent and unspent convictions, and they will take into consideration the circumstances surrounding it. And they really drive the point home by saying, if a firm is not sure whether something may have an impact on an individual's fitness and propriety, the information should be disclosed. We take non-disclosure of material facts very seriously, as it's seen as evidence of current dishonesty. So if in doubt, always disclose. And I think that's interesting, the fact that they call it the current dishonesty. They will consider the circumstances around previous relevant matters, but they're going to be very unhappy if you aren't conspiring with them at the point of submitting your notification for approval. Okay, so now that the FCA have determined that you're not a money laundering drug lord, they're going to want to make sure that you have the competence, the capability, and the experience to perform that role. And they'll do this by looking at your knowledge and experience. They will take a risk-based and proportionate approach. So they'll consider your knowledge and experience in the context of the nature of the firm, the regulated activities that the firm provides, and the potential for market harm should that individual fail to meet the FCA's expectations. So they'll assess your competence and capability based on your employment history and your qualifications. And as part of your application for approval, you'll need to provide a 5-year employment history with all gaps explained. You'll also need to include any reasons for leaving previous roles, and presumably that's to draw out any fitness and proprietary issues that might have that related to a previous role. And then they'll also expect an up-to-date CV, which will include details of your educational background and then also your professional experience on a wider basis. Okay, so I've included a slide here on mind and management, and it might feel like a bit of a segue, but we typically find that the two go hand in hand. And the reason for that is one of the conditions of authorisation in the UK is that you have a head office in the UK. And whilst the regulations don't define head office, the FCA consider it to be the central management and control of the business. So that's the location of the directors and other senior management who make decisions relating to the firm's direction and the material decisions on a day-to-day basis. And it also includes the central administrative functions of the firm. So when we look at that definition, it would be really hard to make the argument that the individuals that fulfill those roles are not PSD or EMD individuals, because they are effectively the central management and control of the business. So the extension of that and the implication of that is really that the SA's expectation is that PSD and EMD individuals would be based in the UK as part of the UK's head office. So to try to bring all of this to light a little bit, I'd like to talk to you about a company called Awesome3. Awesome3 was owned by a South African lady called Mrs. Nomu. And at the beginning of 2019, Mrs. Nomu decided to apply for registration in the UK as a small payment institution, despite the fact that she wasn't a UK resident and she didn't have any intention to move to the UK. So when the SA raised concerns about the UK mind and management issue, Mrs. Nomu submitted a second PSD individual form for a lady called Mrs. Andovu. She was UK resident, but when the SA reviewed her employment history, it became apparent that her entire professional background was in nursing and that actually she had no payment services experience. So unsurprisingly, the FCA weren't satisfied that Mrs. Andovu had the required knowledge or experience to run a payments business. And to her credit, Mrs. Nomu did accept this, but she suggested that a short course in anti-money laundering would fix the problem. Again, unsurprisingly, the FCA felt that the proposed training wouldn't address the shortcomings identified, and eventually they did refuse the application on the basis that Awesome3 did not satisfy the UK mind and management condition because Mrs. Nomu was based in South Africa, and the proposed PSD individual who was based in the UK did not possess the appropriate knowledge and experience to oversee a payments business. So maybe that brings it to light a little bit. And we have talked a lot about the application process to become a PSD or an EMD individual. But what I'd like to draw now is, well, what are the ongoing obligations or responsibilities when you agree to become a PSD or an EMD individual? And really, by agreeing to take on the role of a PSD or an EMD individual, you're accepting personal accountability for the firm's discharge of its regulatory obligations. Whilst there's not an awful lot of prescriptive guidance in terms of what the SA would expect from a PSD or an EMD individual on an ongoing basis, it can be quite useful to nod to the senior management and certification regime, which isn't currently applicable to payments and e-money firms, but it does set out the SA's expectations in terms of what they would expect from an individual employed by a regulated business. So I've listed here the individual conduct rules. And these are the rules that the FCA would expect any person employed by a regulated business to comply with. And there's no surprises here. It very much mirrors the principles for business. And we talk about individuals acting with integrity, being cooperative with the FCA, paying due regard to the interests of customers and making sure they're treated fairly, and observing proper standards of market conduct. So probably of more relevance is the senior management conduct rules. So these are like the senior management conduct rules. Whilst, as I mentioned, they're not, and the SMCR regime isn't currently applicable to payments and e-money firms. And again, it gives an indication of what the FCA's expectations are of senior managers employed by regulated businesses. So their expectation is that you will ensure the business that you work for is controlled effectively, that it complies with the relevant regulatory requirements, and that where responsibility is delegated, it's done so appropriately and responsibly, and that if there's any relevant matters that the FCA should be made aware of, those matters will be disclosed. And so by taking on the PSD or the EMD individual role, when we look at the conduct rules there, you are taking on quite a lot of responsibility. So how do you actually discharge that responsibility? And so as a PSD or an EMD individual, it's your responsibility to ensure that you're transparent with the FCA, and that's both at the point of application. So you disclose any relevant matters when you apply to become a PSD or an EMD individual, and then on an ongoing basis, if there's any change in circumstances that could impact your fitness and propriety, you will tell the FCA about those and about that relevant matter so that they can make an assessment. And to that end, we would expect your compliance team to be contacting you on an annual basis just to confirm that there are no changes and that could impact your fitness and propriety and that the FCA would need to know about. Additionally, there's the ongoing competence and capability. So it's all well and good to to apply to become a PhD or an EMD individual and explain to the SCA the experience you have today and all of the training that you've undertaken and to ensure that you're competent and capable to hold that role. But on an ongoing basis, what are you doing to refresh that understanding and to keep that that knowledge base up to date? You know, is it the case that you're undergoing additional training on an ongoing basis? Or how do you ensure that you keep abreast of the developments in the regulatory environment to make sure that you're able to discharge your regulatory responsibilities appropriately? And then finally, we have reputation. So whilst the FCA have limited powers to go after an EMD or a PhD individual personally, if they do go after your firm, you can be sure that they're going to look at what actions you took. So how can you evidence that you behaved appropriately? What records have you kept in terms of your input and key decision making? And how can you be sure that your reputation is protected? So I've provided you with a bit of a whistle-stop tour through the PhD and the EMD individual regime, and I hope I brought to life some of the key issues that you'll be grappling with. I'm going to invite my colleagues, Alison and Colin, to join the panel to answer a few questions that might help bring to life a little bit more the issues that firms typically experience.
Rachel, thanks very much for that deep dive into what it means to be a PhD EMD individual and what the regulator expects of those individuals. As you said, that leads us nicely into the panel discussion, where we have a few questions for the panel. I'd like to introduce the panel, first of all. So we have Alison Donnelly, and Alison is director in FSCom, and she leads up the payments team. She's also FSA and FCA, an ex-FSA FCA e-money policy specialist, and Colin Sloan, who's senior manager in the payments team, and he's our subject matter expert in helping firms get authorised with the FCA and the CBI, the Central Bank of Ireland. First question is, what kind of things would prevent you from becoming a PhD EMD individual? And I think we'll start with Alison.
Great, thank you. Rachel's given us a great explanation of the areas that the FCA are looking for in terms of the application to become a PhD or EMD individual. So you know that you've got to be able to evidence that you're a fit and proper person and have the appropriate skills and experience, knowledge and experience to be able to deliver and provide payment services. Happily for us, we don't encounter too many applicants that are trying to present a candidate to the FCA who doesn't meet that criteria. Clearly, we work with our firms to help them understand what kind of roles that they need to fill in order to put the right people before the FCA in their applications. But we do know of some situations where people have been asked to withdraw. So generally, the FCA don't necessarily go down a formal process if they can avoid that, just because of the time and resources involved. But what they might do is, you know, if somebody's inappropriate, they'll ask them to withdraw. And the one scenario that I'm thinking of and would be useful to share is that there was a person who failed to declare in their form that they had a connected bankruptcy. So somebody very close to them, involved with their wider business interests, hadn't gone bankrupt, and that wasn't disclosed. And what the FCA said, it was the FSA at that time, what they said was that, like, you know, the bankruptcy is one thing, and that wouldn't necessarily bar you from taking this position and being approved. But because you didn't disclose it to us, that's the problem, and that reinforces what Rachel was saying earlier about, you know, if in doubt, disclose. It's better to put it on the form and set it out there and explain why. And to that point, you know, we have had applicants who have had allegations made against them, and so, for instance, if you googled their names, there would be adverse media that comes up. And but when we put them forward, of course, we need to provide evidence that whilst that information's out there it's not accurate and the situation has moved on and things have changed since, or that it just wasn't accurate at all. So we would put a lot of work into making sure that when we present those candidates, that the full information is disclosed in order to let the FCA make a fair judgment.
Okay, Alison, thank you for that. Okay, we'll move on to the second question then. Can the FCA take enforcement action against a PSD EMD individual personally? And Colin, you answer us that
question. Sure, no problem. So again, this is a very common question because obviously when it comes to personal liability, people pay attention and it's sort of more serious to them. But interestingly, the answer is, as Rachel already alluded to, there's actually very limited circumstances under the regulations, PSRs, EMRs, where the FCA can take enforcement or disciplinary action against an individual. Most of the powers are directed against the firm. So for example, what are those limited circumstances? Well, if the individual lies to or misleads the FCA, the FCA have the power under the regulations to fine the individual. But beyond that, it's actually very limited. But where it becomes, you know, very clear, if you are implicated in FCA enforcement action against the firm, that is significant for you in terms of your future career within the financial services industry. Because if you apply for a senior management position in a financial services firm, practically in any jurisdiction in the world, you will have to disclose that event to the appropriate regulator. I think that is really where this comes home, so to speak, for individuals that are EMD or PSD individuals, the future career prospects that sort of action might entail.
Okay, thank you, Colin. Next question is an SMCR. So yeah, Rachel, you did speak about SMCR and the fact that that doesn't apply yet to payment and e-money institutions. And this question asks, so you mentioned that it doesn't apply yet. Do you think it will in the future?
Yes, it's a short answer. I do expect it to apply in the future. I think the extension of the principles of business to both payment and e-money firms last year gives an indication of the FCA's direction of travel. And also the already extended scope of SMCR it indicates that they're moving towards an alignment of regimes. So I would expect payment and e-money firms to be brought in to scope of the SMCR regime in the not so distant future. And so our advice would be whilst you may not necessarily be in scope of the regime at the moment, it may not be it can be quite a useful exercise to identify those senior managers who could be caught by the regime and map out what their responsibilities are in terms of how would those firms comply with the regime if they were caught by it.
Can I add in there that there are certainly elements that prove very useful, I think, for firms just in terms of good governance and you know, I know there's definitely parts that are overkill and adds complexity where it doesn't need to add complexity. But the heart of it is that it's about good governance and making sure that people are accountable for the decisions that they make. And quite often, I'm sure Rachel and Colin will agree with me that whenever we do an application for a new business and we set out, we explain their governance procedures and we say, well, so-and-so is going to do this and so-and-so is going to do that. And there's all the committees. You know, it's all very good intentions, and particularly where it's a startup business, because, you know, they're they have the fresh sheet, they can start from scratch. So we put all of this pack into the FCA, and then over a course of time, you know, they're busy, they're building up their business. And when we come in maybe a few years later to audit, and we go looking for the minutes of those meetings that they promised to have, and, you know, to identify who all the key people are, things have got overlooked and changed. And I think the SMCR regime sort of pulls you back into figuring out, is this really sufficient? And you know, whilst the payment services regime for non-banks is a, you know, by definition light regime, we still expect good standards to be kept, and any business functions better under good standards.
Absolutely, and one of the things I found helping solar regulated firms to prepare for the advent of SMCR was, it was actually just a really helpful process for them to go through in terms of their governance arrangements and having clear lines of responsibility. So I think it's definitely something that payment and e-money institutions should consider doing just for the benefit of it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to everyone on those answers. Next question, how do you evidence payment services e-money experience? Then, Alison.
Okay, this is a good question. So one of the sort of features of this process is that you have to be able to show that you have knowledge and experience to provide payment services. Actually, the form also asks about your training, which isn't actually in the legislation. The legislation restricted to knowledge and experience to be able to provide payment services. And to the short answer, there is no magic bullet. There's no training program, there's no qualification, there's no minimum number of years that you can show that you have been in whatever type of experience in order to pass muster on this. So there's no easy answer. But what we would point to is looking to the senior management as a whole. We would expect to see sufficient experience to carry out the main functions, and we would expect to see at least a few people who have experience working in payment services firms previously, and if not in payment services firms, very definitely people who come from the regulated sector. And the reason for that is because it's a very different sector. So if you come in to regulation blind, as many payment institutions will have done way back in 2009, whenever the regime came into play, they didn't have previous experience within regulated firms. And so they didn't understand how the regulator works. They didn't understand the expectations and the standards. And, you know, they can get themselves into kind of situations where they work on the basis, well, if the regulator's not specifically asking me to do something or for something, then I can get away with not doing it. And that's absolutely not the right approach for the regulated sector. So it's really important that around that group, we have sufficient experience and understanding of what the regulator expects, plus all the skills and experience needed to do the job that has been set each person. And I think one of the best ways to look at an application is to step back. And as Rachel said at the beginning, you know, you will have gone through a process to understand and why, you know, to assess that the person, the candidate before you, and to accept that they are the right person to do the job that you're giving them. And so that's what should be reflected. You can justify it to yourself, therefore you should be able to justify it to the regulator. I think it gets a little bit more complicated when you have startups who are starting from scratch and coming in, that they're entrepreneurial in spirit and mind, and they haven't got previous experience in the regulated sector or indeed in payment services. And to them, if it really is only them involved in the business, I would strongly suggest they go and work for somebody else in the first instance, or indeed become an agent of somebody else in order to prove concept and get their experience under their belt. I think that's really important. And then the second thing is to surround yourself with the right people. If you can't afford to employ them full time actually in the business, consider getting advisors onto your board, independent directors who will be able to lend their experience and guide you into the right ways.
Alison, thank you. I'm sure everyone agrees that they're very useful tips, especially for anybody starting out in the sector. So we'll have time, I think, here for another question. Maybe we'll go to Colin for this one. Is there a difference with how other regulators operate their regimes, Colin?
Yeah, there is. There are major differences. So the regulator that I'm most experienced with is the Central Bank of Ireland. And I suppose the chief difference there is, well, first of all, the name. They don't use the terminology EMD or PSD individuals. The term is PCF holder, and PCF stands for pre-approval controlled functions. So in contrast to the FCA, who have this blanket category EMD or PSD individual, which applies to all directors, all senior managers, as sort of Rachel's outlined, they split it up into the different roles and functions. So there are about maybe 45 PCF functions. Now, thankfully, you don't have to employ 45 staff at the outset, but there is a core requirement that the central bank place upon applicants. So, for example, you would need to have the CEO function filled. You would need to have a CFO function filled, COO, head of compliance, head of risk, MLRO, head of internal audit, interestingly. Now, there is opportunity to amalgamate those functions in specific individuals if you can persuade the central bank that they have sufficient bandwidth. But it does mean that at the end of the day, you really need more staff on the ground in Ireland than you would with the FCA. So quite major differences there. But again, with that split in functions, you do have more individual accountability. So central bank, you could argue, are maybe a bit ahead of the game in terms of where the FCA are heading to maybe in the future and in applying SMCR to payment and e-money firms.
Okay, thank you very much, Colin. So big differences there then with the central bank compared to the FCA, by the sounds of it. Okay, so I think we'll move back then to Rachel to finish things off with some key takeaways. Rachel.
Thank you to both Alison and Colin for joining us for the panel discussion. I think the examples that you were able to bring to the table really help bring the regime to life, so thank you. And I think the key takeaways for me from both the presentation and from the panel discussion afterwards are transparency, ongoing competence, capability and reputation. So with transparency, that's being transparent with the regulator at the outset when you're submitting your application for approval and ensuring that you're including all relevant disclosures. But that transparency goes beyond just the application stage. So if there are any changes in circumstances that the FCA would expect to be notified of as a PSD or an EMD individual or purely by being employed by a regulated firm, it's your responsibility to be cooperative and transparent with the regulator. So the expectation is that you would notify them as soon as possible. And as I mentioned earlier, we would expect that your head of compliance or your compliance department would be reaching out to you on an annual basis, at least, just to ensure that there's no change in circumstances that the FCA would expect to be notified of. And then in terms of ongoing competence and capability, as I've already mentioned, this isn't relevant just at the point of authorization. What are you doing to ensure that your competence and capability is at the right level and throughout your career? Is it appropriate to undergo additional training? What horizon scanning are you doing to ensure that you're aware of the issues that are relevant to your business and the issues that the FCA are focusing on to ensure that you keep on top of that and that you remain, the knowledge and experience that you have remains appropriate to fulfill that role. And then finally, reputation. Both the safeguarding the reputation of the business which you're employed by and also your own reputation. And as Colin mentioned, the personal liability, the FCA's powers in terms of going after you individually may not be, you know, they may be quite narrow in scope. But as I mentioned, they will, if they're looking at the business that you're employed by, they're going to look at what actions you took. So what can you do to safeguard your reputation? And that goes back to making sure that where you're involved in decision making, and that you're keeping a record of what your input was, and that the actions that you took were in line with what the FCA would expect. And then that goes further in terms of your career within the financial services industry. If you get a black mark against your name whilst employed by the firm you're currently employed by, and then you go to take on a role at another firm, you're going to have to disclose that issue as part of that application. So it's really important to safeguard your reputation as well as the businesses. So hopefully that's given you all a really good overview of the regime, and we've talked about some of the more relevant issues once you've been approved by the FCA. If there's any questions, if you're sitting there with any questions that you haven't had a chance to put forward to Elaine, do feel free to reach out to us to get in touch, and we'll be more than happy to cover those separately.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, Alison and Colin, as well, for everyone sharing your words of wisdom. I know I've learned a lot this afternoon, and thanks everybody else for their attention and participation. The recording will be available in the follow-up email, and as Rachel said, any other questions, feel free to reach out to any of the panelists. So look, thank you, take care, and stay safe, everybody.
Thanks.